welcome to Anomalous Waves, a podcast discussing all things strange. I'm John.
I'm Ami, and this is Lilliput.
We're finally doing a regular episode. It's been, I think the last one was like February.
We've been on a hiatus.
Been on a little bit of a hiatus, but we're back and we're ready to get back into it. And I'm super excited to finally be talking about the Highgate Vampire.
I am going to be talking about the Carter brothers and a mysterious man.
So yeah, we'll give some more updates at the end of the episode. But for now, let's just dive in, eh?
Let's do it. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. When John and I were in New Orleans, we did a couple tours. One of them was a ghost tour called French Quarter Phantoms Tour. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was on St. Patrick's Day, and there was so many drunk college kids and adults that were walking around the street at the same time as, like, all these tours. It was hilarious, huh?
It was really fun.
It was a funny dynamic. It was, like, drunk people partying, then a couple families trying to do a family thing in the French Quarter.
It was awesome.
Big contrast.
They gave you 2-for-1 hurricanes with your thing, so got to walk around with a hurricane and listen to these stories of ghosts and vampires.
Yeah, we got to keep the cup.
Yep.
So, anyways, our guide took our group to all the best spooky spots, and then we got to a home on the 800 block of Royal Street, and our guide told us the place was home to the infamous Carter brothers. Now, I had never heard of them before.
Yeah, me either. Yeah.
What the guy told us was one of the most fascinating stories I have ever heard, and I knew I just wanted to dive in deeper into these terrible turds. That's all I'll call them. So like many cities and towns across the United States, the Great Depression severely impacted Louisiana and really hit New Orleans hard. Throughout the 19th century, the port of New Orleans was the largest in the southern United States. But when the Depression hit in the 1930s, the port was kind of left empty, I guess, which I didn't know. The Great Depression left 10,000 people in New Orleans unemployed, and the city started a welfare system in 1931 to give relief to these people, but the money actually ran out by 1932. So it was just a lot of poverty and a lot of homeless people. It was kind of like the perfect time for predators like the Carter brothers to strike. The Carter brothers were kind of mysterious. They were rumored to work dock jobs by day and murdered by night. Their secret life was exposed to the public when a girl who was around 10 years old went to authorities to say that she had been kidnapped by 2 men who had been feeding on her. She then showed the officers her wrists, which had small lacerations. And somehow the child remembered where she escaped from, and she took the cops to the home on Royal Street. The police went inside, and what they found was just disturbing. There was 12 dead bodies that had been drained of all their blood, and there was still 4 victims who were living, and they were tied up, and they also had wounds on their wrists like the little girl. The victim said that the Carter brothers were consuming their blood. But the Carter brothers were nowhere to be found, so the police staked out the house. And when the brothers showed up, it took 8 officers to restrain them. But the oddest thing is the Carter brothers were of average height and build for the time. So they were about my height, 5'5", 5'6". And they were, I think, estimated to be like in their 40s. And this was 8 young officers. The officer said they just had extreme strength.
Mm.
The brothers were tried for their crimes and executed. They were sealed in a tomb, and 1 year and 1 day later, when I am not sure of the word, so I'm going to use tomb keeper, he opened up the tomb to put in a new body.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing there. Nothing at all.
Like not even the like, because usually he explained to us, right?
Yeah.
That there would usually be, like, some leftover bones and like that.
Yeah.
And they would usually take the dried, like, ashy part, push that back.
Yeah.
And then take the bones and stuff, put it in a bag, and put it, like, in the corner.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There was nothing. Okay. Like, there was no evidence that a body had ever been in there.
Whoa.
Now, people who resided in the Carter brothers' home have said that the building is haunted, and they have seen two men who fit to a T the description of the Carter brothers. They've been seen, like, for years. Now, on our tour, we learned that one of the victims who survived this horrible tragedy went on to be a killer himself, and he claimed to have killed over 400 people.
I was going
to
say, didn't he, like, learn how to, like, get away with it,
yeah,
supposedly?
Yeah. I looked it up and didn't find anything about it. Supposedly, his first name was Philippe, but I didn't find anything at all.
Okay.
Now, I came across another story of a mysterious man named Count Saint Germain.
Okay, it sounds familiar.
Now, he was an alchemist.
Ooh.
Who was born in the late 1600s to a prince of Transylvania.
Of course.
He was rumored to be immortal, and some say that he was alive, like, during the time of Jesus' birth. Like, he was way older than they thought he was. There was an article published in the Newcastle Weekly Chronicle on February 6th, 1886, almost 140 years ago.
That's a poppin' year.
Yeah, so like people have been talking about this guy for a long time. It says, the speculation of a luxurious age, a man of mystery, a 300-year-old eyewitness, and the secret of elixir of life. Now, it has an interview with a woman named Madame du Pompadour. They called her the King's Diamond.
Mm. She sounds familiar too.
Yeah. So the article sets the tone by saying about 50 years before the downfall of Bastille, the court of life, which I have not had a world history class in God knows how many years. So for those who need a refresher, just like me, I looked it up for us. So on July 14th, 1789, a crowd of several thousand people laid siege to the Bastille, a royal fortress, prison, and armory in eastern Paris. Now, it was a standoff, lasted hours, and then finally these people gained access to Bastille, overwhelmed, like, the guards, and they murdered the governor. So the fall of this place kind of helped start the French Revolution, I guess.
Okay.
All right. Back to the article. Basically, this time in Europe, it was like a very curious time. They were interested in the mystics, and it was a time of like low morals and indulgence.
My favorite.
Now, the article says the representative man of that time was not the statesman, the philosopher, the painter, or the poet, but a charlatan.
Yeah.
Among the most successful of the number was the mysterious Count Saint Germain. So he just kind of sounds almost like a pseudo-intellectual. Now, Count Saint Germain's age and personal backstory was kind of unknown, but the Count just sort of popped up in Paris. He was supposed to have, like, really good manners, was loaded, and people just really loved talking to him. It sounds like if he was at a party, like, everybody's like, oh, yeah, let's talk to this guy. He's got all the knowledge.
All the knowledge and the money.
He was a frequent guest at elaborate parties and dinners. But this is the weird thing. He was never spotted eating or drinking.
Mm.
Like, nobody ever saw him eat food. People said that the Count had knowledge of events that happened 200 years prior to the 1700s. It was details that were almost too descriptive, like you had to have been there to witness it. Now the Count told people, I have no power to make old people young again, but had the secret of arresting decay in the human frame. And when people would ask, like, why do you look so young? But you, how do you know all this stuff? But you're only, like, look like you're 45 years old. He would just say, like, he's a little bit older than he looks, but he credited it to his diet.
which was?
Groats, oatmeal, and white meat, and have little to no wine. So it doesn't really make sense. It's like, hey, you know all this stuff from 200 years ago, but you're 45 years old. He's like, good diet. That's all I can tell you.
Just some oats and white meat.
Oatmeal. I love oatmeal. So.
I eat oatmeal every morning. Why don't I know information from 200 years ago?
So as I continued to read the article, I noticed the count's resume was also growing by the minute. Like all these things that he said he could do. He was fluent in 7 languages, and he was, like, learning 6 others. He was a self-proclaimed historian. That explains it all the history.
Yes.
Alchemist. He would even melt down, like, small diamonds to make honkin' ones. And he said his best skill was the elixir he used to gain immortality. Oatmeal.
Oatmeal. The elixir of life. That should be a marketing campaign. Just, we should start St. Germain's Oatmeal Company.
We should. So, word of this mysterious man, of course, got back to a woman named Madame de Pompadour. Okay. She was the Sultana of the court, and she invited the Count to come meet her, to kind of come to a party. Now, she sounds really interesting, too. She had, like, her own fortune teller.
Nice.
Yeah.
Her just own on Oracle.
Call.
Yeah.
Now, a woman named the Countess von Gregory heard that the Count was going to come visit the Madame, and she recalled knowing a Count named Count de Saint Germain from Venice in 1710. She went to the event. She wanted to see, like, could it be a relative? Was it somebody that took his name? And she was shocked to see it was the same man from all those years ago. And he looked like he had not aged like one day. So he should have been around 100 years old by that time. But he still looked like a guy in his 40s. All he had to say for himself was, Madame, I am very old.
Yep, I'm getting more and more marketing ideas for St. Germain's oatmeal. Ma'am, I am very old. And it's just him eating oats on the front.
Oh, man. Now, the Count, like, went on from there to make diamonds for the king. And after he, like, made them, he produced them to the king. And the king took it to, like, his jeweler. And they told him it was worth, like, a buttload. It was worth so much money, what he had created.
Exactly one buttload.
One buttload, yeah. And after this, you know, he was, like, really popular there, really hip on the scene. Then he just disappeared, just left Paris, kind of without a trace. And he just seems to have popped up across Europe for, like, 50 years after that. But he went by different names. He was known as Marquis of Montferrat. Didn't pronounce that right, but I tried. This was in Venice. And then Count Bellemere in Pisa, Chevalier Schoen in Milan, Chevalier Wedlon in Genoa, and Count Solkoff at Schwischelbach, and Count Zargery. He, like, went to Russia even for a while.
How do they know it's him?
I think he would bump into people from his past, even in all these places, and then they just linked him to all these different locations.
Super cool.
I think he probably got carried away, and he'd be like, well, when I was in Paris, I made diamonds.
Yep.
And guess what? He can also add to his resume now.
What?
Member of secret society.
Yes.
Societies, I should say. He was linked to several secret societies. So some of them were just the Freemasons, Knights of Light, Illuminati, and Order of the Templars.
Wow.
Templars, I should say.
He was in the real good ones.
The 18th century philosopher Voltaire actually said that the Count was a man who never dies and knows everything.
Oh my gosh.
So the Count was rumored to have died in Hamburg, Germany in 1784. But he was seen into the 20th century in Germany. He was a representative for the Freemasonry in 1785. He was seen by a comatose who claims to have seen him several times leading up to 1820, and he still looked like a man of 40 years old, like 40 to 45 years old, I should say.
This is so cool.
Now, Germain decided to travel to the New World for spiritual fulfillment, and he decided to hit New Orleans first.
Amen, buddy. That's where I would go to.
Now, in New Orleans, he was known as Jacques Saint Germain. Saint Germain threw some big parties at his home on Royal Street, and he had very elite guests. He was never seen eating food or drinking there either. And he had like a party one night, and he had a lady guest stay like later than everybody else. And they were kind of hanging out on his like balcony. And then he tried to bite her neck.
And she escaped.
She escaped. She told police, told them where to go. And when they got there, he vanished. But the police found a tablecloth with blood splattered all over it, a bunch of clothes from like different eras of time, and wine bottles full of human blood. Now, this man of mystery is rumored to still travel the world.
So cool.
He doesn't seem like he ever tried to bite anybody when he was in Europe. I never found any accounts of him doing that.
He was just very sneaky about it.
Very sneaky about it. And I didn't really find anything about like what exactly his elixir of life was. But I think we all know now.
Oatmeal.
Yeah, he was just always very, very, very wealthy. No matter where he was, he never lost his wealth.
Super cool.
And why are vampires always wealthy?
I mean, if you live for a really long time and you're just good at murdering people, you could take a lot of stuff.
That's true.
And if they have any sort of that hypnotizing ability, you could just go into places and be like, you would like to invest in my travels, wouldn't you?
He charmed everyone.
Yeah. And I've just got oats on my mind now.
I have some oatmeal after this.
No, that was truly fascinating.
I mean, the tips he gave back then, I mean, we still use those tips now. So...
What tips?
About eating only like the white meat.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically chicken meat is what he said, actually. Oats, oatmeal.
It's so funny, too, because if you think about it, he was probably just like telling you the diet to eat to make your blood taste the best.
Oh, that's right. Little to no wine.
Yeah, not too much.
Lots of water. You got to stay hydrated. Maybe throw in some greens. No garlic. Yeah. Also, please no dairy. I'm lactose intolerant.
Makes the blood curdle. Okay. I'm pretty sure we've nailed that.
Yeah.
Good work. The Highgate Vampire is a wild cluster of a case from the early 1970s surrounding Highgate Cemetery in North London, England. It involves satanic panic, witchcraft, mass hysteria, media hysteria, Hammer horror films, and an 8-foot-tall black apparition with red eyes.
Ooh.
But I was thinking, how do I want to tackle this wild ride? And I decided I'm going to start with the perspective of David Ferrant, primarily use an article written by David in 2009 called The Highgate Vampire, How It All Began. So David writes that in 1969, the British Psychic and Occult Society, or BPOS, as I will call it the rest of the time, which, according to their current Facebook page, was founded by lifetime president David Ferrant in 1967 as a platform for general interest in all things esoteric, psychic, and paranormal. So the BPOS was receiving reports of a tall black apparition that had been lurking among the tombs of Highgate Cemetery. David says that many of these reports were followed up, but many were nothing more than repetition of local rumors. but he did follow up with one man. David writes, according to this person, referred to here as Thornton, he had been hypnotized by something in the cemetery after he had gone there late one afternoon to look around. As the light began to fail, he decided to leave, but somehow he became hopelessly lost. Not being a superstitious person or even believing in the existence of ghosts, he walked calmly around looking for the gate when he suddenly became aware of the presence of something behind him. Swinging around less than 6 feet away, he saw a tall, dark specter hovering just above the ground. He found himself transfixed to the spot, completely unable to move, drained of energy by some powerful hypnotic force that in a matter of seconds rendered him unconscious to any sense of time or his surroundings. So great was the intensity of this force that he remained like this for several minutes, or what seemed like several minutes, before the specter abruptly vanished and he slowly regained his normal faculties. Recalling the incident afterwards, Thornton said that it was almost as if some force of terribly evil proportions had actually sought him out with the intention of doing serious harm. So that's the first story that really captivated David's interest.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. David calls this man's account intriguing. One, because the man was an accountant, so pretty like rational, normal type of fella.
Pretty serious.
Also, the man said this thing sought him out and wished to do him harm. This is something David found to be incredibly rare in reports of ghostly figures. So David followed up with more reports, but these two seemed to be nothing more than rumor. David writes, an exception to this, however, was one old lady who claimed she had been frightened by a tall, dark man who floated at her from within the cemetery gates. She had been walking her dog late one night, but as she approached the gates of the cemetery, it started to howl and tried to retreat. She looked up and saw a figure with glaring eyes staring at her. In a matter of seconds, it promptly vanished. So now he's got two accounts that are kind of similar.
Yeah.
So David went to Highgate searching for a hoax. Is there, you know, some trees that make this weird shadow, like at dusk? Does it, you know, like trying to find a logical explanation, but he didn't find any. He also mentions that this time he had not been to the cemetery for roughly 2 years, and it had been extremely vandalized. He says one skeleton was out of a coffin, and another vault had a coffin that was set on fire.
Do they not have like a groundskeeper?
Now, the vandalizing of the cemetery is pretty important in this case and will pop up several times. He also mentioned that there was little to no effort to repair the damages, as well as a dead fox that he found in the middle of the main pathway.
Ooh.
He says there was no outwardly visible cause of death, and that it was strange that a wounded animal usually would have crawled away to hide when facing impending death. David decided that the only way to see if this was worth exploring further was to stay the night. So he would do this on December 21st, 1969, the eve of the winter solstice. So it's around 11 p.m. David is walking down the narrow path that goes alongside the cemetery when he feels a presence and the impression that he is no longer alone. David hears a large animal scurry in the bushes to the right and then looks up and sees a tall, dark figure about 5 yards away from the gate. David writes, instinctively, my conscious mind rejected this figure as being supernatural. It was more consoling to assume that it was somebody wandering through the cemetery. Notwithstanding that the figure appeared to be over 7 feet tall, any immediate doubts were soon dispelled when I saw two reddish eyes meeting my gaze from a black mass at the top of the shape, which I took to be its head. But these eyes were not human, rather reflected some alive presence. They were dull and penetrating like some hungry wolf, although the rest of it had no discernible features apart from a vague human shape. After this, he goes, yeah, we're investigating Highgate Cemetery. So an investigation began officially in January of 1970. Every night they would hold what they called a vigil.
Okay.
They'd have two members of the group in different areas where the witnesses encountered the specter. They set up cameras, tape recorders, all that kind of jazz first, because they felt it was really important to try to gather like actual evidence before doing any kind of like psychic contact rituals or experiments with this thing. And while researching the history of Highgate Cemetery, David found accounts of apparitions all the way back to the Victorian era.
Oh.
One of the common tales he found was of a tall man dressed in black who would disappear mysteriously through the cemetery walls. So very similar.
There's always spooky stuff in the Victorian era, I swear.
And that would be really exciting, having these weird stories and then doing research and finding more examples of them.
Yeah.
That most likely this accountant didn't know of. And then David's own personal experience now. David also claimed that, I brought up the vandalism, he claimed that there was evidence of satanic masses being performed at the cemetery and that they were performed in what he said was a great professional style, running through a maze of catacombs and could not have been performed by amateurs. Even going on to say that there was a small mausoleum with a marble floor and no coffins that was used as a small temple to summon what he called the most malign deities to rule amongst the old kings of hell. So it's important to state that David also practices magic and in many different ways, but he's specifically saying that the symbolism he's seeing is specifically from satanic masses summoning something bad. That's his point of view. So 2 weeks into the investigation, and the specter has been spotted on two separate occasions by members of the BPOS. Once behind two members who all of a sudden felt compelled to turn around and witness it. The other time, two members saw it through the top gate on their way to their nightly vigil. Both times, it disappeared within a few seconds. The BPOS found several more dead foxes in the cemetery, but this time with deep wounds in the foxes' throats. In this article, David states that there really isn't much evidence to connect to a vampire, but it was an interesting speculation. He previously mentioned the vampiristic connotations, like the hypnotizing and the gliding and floating and all that kind of stuff. And he also mentioned the possibility of Bram Stoker being inspired by Highgate Cemetery when writing Dracula. But we've heard that. We've heard a couple different, he was inspired by this.
Yeah.
Things, haven't
There's
we?
Always new things that he yeah. gets inspired by.
But I guess he mentioned Highgate Cemetery in the book, which I have not read, so.
I am reading it, so I haven't come to that yet.
Ooh, very cool. Give us an update. David had written a letter to the local paper asking if others had seen the specter, and purposely leaving out the word vampire altogether. He received several responses. One of them said, "My fiance and I spotted a most unusual form about a year ago. It just seemed to glide across the path. Although we waited a little while, it did not reappear again. I'm glad someone else has spotted it. I was convinced it was not my imagination." That's Miss Audrey Connolly. And this was February 13th, 1970. There's several other kind of very similar accounts. But the paper noticed that the whole vampire thing was quite a bit of a better seller, I would say, and wrote an article on March 6, 1970, titled, "Why Do the Foxes Die?" In the article, it implies that this specter is indeed a vampire, and that both David and Sean Manchester agree that it was a vampire. The media, you will see throughout the next couple parts, are a big part of this whole thing and misquote David and stuff quite often. So also, the next episode will be about Sean Manchester, so I'm not going to talk much about him. But I will say he's an author who wrote a lot about this topic, claims to be a vampire hunter, and claims to be a bishop of the old Catholic Church. Take that with whatever grain of salt you want. During the same time, David claims that he was receiving letters from practicing Satanists. And one of them stated, "By your interference with the work of our high order, you have invoked the wrath of Lord Haddit. By his element and the power of the sevenfold cross, you shall now be destroyed. This is decreed by his grace, and this wish will be fulfilled through our order. Be it thus so." The letter was signed in blood and covered in symbols.
Wonder who gave the blood. who's giving the blood this week for the letters? Gary, you up?
So the media, of course, was extremely interested in the story. And in March of 1970, they convinced David to be a part of the coverage. David agreed to tell a story, but claims he wanted to avoid the whole vampire thing. Now, someone he doesn't mention by name in the article, he says this person, but it's very obvious that it's Sean Manchester, stated that indeed it was a king vampire, and after producing a crucifix and a homemade wooden stake, announced that to destroy a vampire, one must first drive a stake through its heart with one blow, chop off its head with a gravedigger's shovel, then burn what remains.
I've never heard the gravedigger's shovel thing.
Sean, I'm excited to look into Sean Manchester. Let's just say that.
But how would they know if it was a gravedigger's shovel? Like, can you just, like, what if you, like, say that that time we found the dead bird in our backyard and we dug, like, a little grave? Could it count as a gravedigger's shovel then?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what qualifies it?
I think you have to believe that it's a gravedigger shovel.
I want to know.
I don't make the rules, okay? Sean does.
I know, Sean. Tell me.
So, yeah, pretty obvious that David doesn't agree with this person, aka Sean Manchester, or his sensationalism. Sean also said, I'll just say Sean because I know it's him, even though David just says this person. David Ferrant would be returning to Highgate Cemetery that same evening to perform this dangerous mission. And for further effect, he warned of what he saw as the dangerous consequences facing anyone foolish enough to take on the King Vampire. David claims that this coverage, specifically, that went out, and this person's remarks were the cause for hundreds of people that converged onto Highgate Cemetery to witness this vampire hunt. Most of them, David labeled as hooligans with beer cans and makeshift weapons. The London Evening News reported the situation by saying,
"Nearly 100 people joined in a vampire hunt at Highgate Cemetery today. They included a vampire expert named Mr. Alan Blood, who journeyed 40 miles to investigate the legend of an undead Satan-like being said to lurk in the area. Spectators gathered in the spooky darkness after watching a TV interview last night, Friday the 13th, in which a man said he was going to exorcise an evil spirit he claimed he had seen three times."
Once again, misquoting David. Still tying him in with the vampire stuff when he's like, interesting theory, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out too, guys.
Several other people, aka the hooligans, claim to have seen things that night. Anthony Robinson, age 27, of Austell Road, Hampstead, came to the cemetery after hearing of the torchlight hunt. "I walked past the place and heard a high-pitched noise. Then I saw something gray moving slowly across the road. It terrified me. First time I couldn't make it out, it looked eerie. I've never believed in anything like this, but now I'm sure there's something evil lurking in Highgate." So David doesn't put like much into these sightings and says it's most likely a product of mass hysteria, but he fears the public sensationalism and this person, aka Sean Manchester, have caused damage to the case, the investigation, and the cemetery, as well as the media, including his name as the main instigator and as a true believer in these vampire sightings.
Yeah, it's like it's all set out to discredit him.
Mm-hmm. So they continued, the BPOS continued their nightly vigils still, but said that they didn't really have any sightings after this, and maybe it was because of all the unwanted attention.
I'm just still surprised that an anchor would talk about it, because the anchor I worked with refused to report on Groundhog's Day.
Wow.
Just a fun fact.
Yeah, these people ate this up. They loved it. So they decided, okay, we're not really getting much action. Let's do a full-on occult ceremony, summon the entity, and try to chat with it.
Mm.
But he said, you know, some unforeseen events took place and made it so they had to pick a future date for this. In August of 1970, the body of a woman was dragged from a vault in Highgate Cemetery, staked in the heart, and left in the middle of a main path. It was found by two schoolgirls.
Mm.
Vandalism was pretty common around this cemetery. But the stake through the heart is a direct link to the media's obsession with the vampire narrative.
It's almost like a witch hunt.
The new day of the seance was decided, and it was to be at midnight on August 17th, only a few days before the full moon. David writes, "In requirements for this ritual, a large circle was inscribed upon the ground, which was adorned by protective symbols and sealed with consecrated water and salt. Some 10 feet away from this, where the phenomenon would be summoned to appear, a smaller circle was cast with protective symbols. It had not been overlooked that we were dealing with a particularly lethal form of psychic energy." Only a few minutes into the seance, the police came. The group all ran in different directions. David made his way to the back wall of the gate, which is where the cops were, but he thought maybe he could beat them when he was seen by a flashlight and just like quickly arrested. He attempted to toss his gear into a bush, which included candles, incense, a wooden cross adorned with protective magical symbols, and a small tape recorder.
Of course, the essentials.
But they found it. He was arrested for being in an enclosed area for an unlawful purpose. Like you said, it's basically a witch hunt at this time. They claimed in the papers, and I read several paper accounts from even U.S. random papers, that he was found with just a cross and a wooden stake. But David claims it was simply a pointed piece of wood with a string that is used to measure out like a perfect circle for his magical circle. He was wary of giving details due to the occult nature. He knew people would just witch hunt him.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to get his friends in trouble or the other members of the BPOS. Case was ultimately dismissed. There's some interesting details about it in the article. But pretty much because he'd already been associated with the case because of the media and the TV. And that he didn't, like, cause any direct damage to the coffins or anything. They couldn't prove that he did any of that. Of course, the media still went absolutely insane, spreading the vampire aspect of the case even further and wider. David writes, the Daily Express said, for example, that the society had over 100 members looking for vampires all over Europe. This kept the hooligans coming, and grave desecration went up to an alarming rate.
Mm.
David was writing an article about these satanic practices that he believed were going on at Highgate Cemetery when BBC decided to try and catch the vampire themselves. They didn't catch the vamp, of course, but they did catch the shocking damage caused at Highgate Cemetery, which some held David and the BPOS personally responsible for. Even though I think it was the media. Meanwhile, a young woman was claiming that she had been attacked by a vampire in Swain's Lane, which which ran alongside the cemetery. She was returning home in the early hours, walking down Swain's Lane. As she passed the cemetery a little way further on, she was suddenly thrown to the ground with tremendous force by a tall black figure with a deathly white face. At that moment, a car stopped to help her, and the figure vanished in the glare of the headlights. She was taken to the Highgate police station and in a state of severe shock, suffering abrasions to her knees and elbows. The police immediately made a thorough search of the area, but found no trace of the attacker. More mysterious still was the fact that where the figure had vanished, the cemetery was lined by 15-foot-high walls. So now David's concerned because the entity is going from terrifying people to physically attacking people in his mind. So he said it's time to commit to a full-on ceremony at Highgate to counteract the activities of a satanic coven who had violated magical law by evoking a malevolent evil force to execute their own desires. David's words, not mine. Don't talk that cool.
Don't talk fancy.
So then David goes kind of into the magical practice and like the details of the ritual that I personally found fascinating, but I'm going to leave that up to you. So as midnight approached, the medium began to make the commands for manifestation, and almost immediately the circle turned icy cold, as though some warm power had suddenly left it, and the candles went out. Simultaneously, the fire in the triangle was obliterated by a misty smoke, and some sinister force seemed to be amidst everyone present. For the next minute or so, nothing happened. There was no wind, and it seemed unnaturally silent, and the fire in the circle cast an eerie red glow over everything. Suddenly, the area was full of a dense mist, more intense around the triangle, and in this, scarcely discernible through the haze, was a quivering black shape that seemed to be trying to materialize. The medium spoke aloud, attempting to aid its materialization, and all at once, two eyes could be seen at the top of the moving black form. They were the same eyes that I had witnessed inside the gate, dull, red, and almost diabolically evil. Only this time, they had increased in strength to such a degree that it was like being confronted by some living presence. A woman present screamed during this and fainted. And David describes them all like not even noticing, really, just kind of being in a trance. He and the others described that there was no sense of imminent evil intent from the entity, but more like it was trying to absorb them.
Like their energy?
That's what I'm thinking.
Like their life force?
Their life force. That's what I'm thinking from the other reports too. They weren't able to continue the full ritual, so instead they performed a rite of banishment and the entity vanished. So in this blog, he writes that they attempted to return to get photographic evidence, but the cemetery was being watched by the cops, and two members of the BPOS was once again arrested, but this time immediately released. But the group's name was once again in the paper, and I'll leave it there. This is like just the first part of the case. But yeah, in part two, I'll talk about Sean Manchester and the King Vampire. And now it's time for a new segment. Ami looks into something deeper after it's claimed to be fact on Beyond Belief Fact or Fiction.
So last night we watched an episode about a psychic horse who helps rescue a missing child. Well, spoiler alert, it's true. There was a horse that was supposed to be psychic. The horse was named Lady Wonder. And in the 1920s, her owner, Claudia Fonda, taught her how to move lettered and numbered children's blocks with her nose. Now, Claudia even designed a piano-sized contraption with a double row of keys. a touch of Lady Wonder's snout on a lever would cause a tin card with a letter or a number to pop up. And through the system, Lady was able to solve math problems, spell words, and was psychic. It is estimated that over 150,000 people went to Lady Wonder for her psychic abilities. They would pay $1 for 3 questions, and they would ask her things about, like, where was their oil? What's the upcoming election gonna be like? Or even, like, what should we bet for the horse races or boxing matches? In 1952, Lady's abilities were really put to the test when she was asked for assistance in finding a missing boy. Now, Lady spelled out Pittsfield Water Wheel when asked for his whereabouts. And everybody was kind of confused because there was no water wheel in the area. Authorities wondered if the letters were instead supposed to be Field and Wild Water Pit, which is a nearby abandoned quarry. On a hunch, they investigated the area and they found the missing boy's body. Edward Stabb was a professional horse trainer, and he caught wind of Lady Wonder's powers. And when he investigated her skills, he said his findings were not conclusive. And a psychologist, however, believed that Lady Wonder was the real deal. Some wondered if Fonda was just pointing Lady Wonder, like, where to answer the question. And oddly enough, Fonda even had a piano-playing Pomeranian. Lady Wonder passed away in 1957, and no one ever really learned if she was indeed a psychic horse. I'm going to say she was.
Thanks again for tuning in to another episode of Anomalous Waves. If you enjoy what you heard today, consider supporting the show. The best way to do that is to become a patron. Just go to patreon.com/anomalouswaves. You can also check the show notes for random links to things we talked about today, as well as our social media and our contact information. If you have a spooky story or like a cool topic or feedback, movie suggestion for Lilliput's movie mausoleum, just email us at anomalouswaves@gmail.com or message us on Instagram. In the show notes, you'll also find links to some merch. Got a couple t-shirts and other things. I will be adding more and more as we get more ideas. I'm already starting to think of a St. Germain's oatmeal t-shirt that I would really like to make.
Madame, I am very old.
That'll be on it. There's also links to support the show just through donations. If you like the show but you don't want to like subscribe and be a patron, but you still want to help financially, you can just leave us a little tip. Another great way to support the show is to rate us. Go on Apple Podcasts, leave a rating, leave a review. Then when other people are looking for a new podcast, they might see your nice review and listen. We're not really into social media, honestly. Not super into like marketing stuff. So really the best way you can help us is by spreading the word. Tell your local vampire hunter.
Tell an alchemist.
Tell a tall, dark apparition with red glowing eyes. Floating towards you. Just scream it at them.
Tell a countess.
But really, most of all, just tell anybody who likes anything weird. Yeah, thanks so much for listening.
Lunchish. Lilliput.